Hello, Brooklyn, how you doing? G, where you going? We cannot come to. And if I can, I'm gonna be your man. You can be my lady and have my baby and drive my car. You got me crazy. So crazy. However you going, baby, where you going? Just take me, cause I'm so taken. If you take it, I'm just saying, baby, I'm just saying.
Hello, Nets fans, how you doing? It's the Russell and Fro podcast, but you already knew that because you went to Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, you name it, clicked on us, press play. We appreciate it. We're back. It's about time for an off-season preview from your boy, Brett, the man bun Garofalo, Carl, the talent Jackson, Russell here, Fro there, as always. Ladies and gentlemen, it's been a big week for Joe's. Joe Biden won the presidency. Joe Flacco just passed Joe Montana for 20th in all-time passing yards, a whole other discussion we can get into. Now it's time for our boy Joe Tsai to step up and hopefully have a championship-caliber offseason for the Nets. We'll get into that in a little bit, but first, it's been a little bit, man. Carl, how you doing?
Well, Brett, as we were talking about pre-show, I've had a couple beers. I've moved on to a scotch, as they say. Beer before liquor, something about Serge Zwicker. That's a deep cut right there.
Did you say Cole Zwicker?
Did I say Cole Zwicker? I think I said Serge Zwicker, but I meant Cole Zwicker. God damn it. I can't even cut my deep cuts well. Anyway, if I don't know if we know exactly when the moratorium is going to be lifted for free agency this year, but I think looking at the Nets cap sheet, we can definitely say it will be happening on Joe Cyber Monday. Am I right?
Ooh. Okay, that was pretty good.
You're generous.
Either way, I know that you and I are going to be texting each other furiously from the Thanksgiving dinner table. Multiple family members will be angry at us. I don't care. I'm going to set that expectation. It's going to get weird.
I mean, they're not going to be angry at me because I don't think we're allowed to have anybody over. So, I will be on the text waves.
I think we're going to have a six-person Thanksgiving. It's going to be wild.
That sounds great. Honestly, like, I think it's kind of fun. Like, I'm going to just make the food the way I want to make the food and eat it, and that's going to be great.
And then maybe wear PJs all day. Maybe not even dress up.
Who knows? Maybe I won't even wear pants. Just food in the nude. all right. So in all seriousness, though, I am very excited for this because – we get to go, like, I mean, you could tell people pretty much every single day. I think I text you roughly 7,000 words of fake trades because I'm lonely. And, I think it's pretty exciting to get to bring them to bear today to go through all these. So pretty pumped about it.
Yeah, I think the last one was, could we potentially trade with the MLS or the NFL? And maybe.
Hey, exploring all options. So why don't we start with just like the first question we got to answer, man, is just like, who even are the Nets? That's because we have Kyrie Irving at point guard, but, no, seriously, if the season started today, and it doesn't, it starts in like 3 weeks, what would this team look like? So, you know, at this exact moment, because Joe Harris is a free agent, your starting lineup for the Brooklyn Nets, I think, would be Kyrie Irving, Caris LeVert, Torian Prince, I believe, Kevin Durant, DeAndre Jordan, with a bench unit of Spencer Dinwiddie, Garrett Temple, assuming they pick up his team option, Timothy Luau-Cabarrot, assuming that they guarantee his deal, Rodions Karux, and Jared Allen. You also have Nick Claxton and Janin Musa are the other two players under contract. So those 12 guys are under contract currently or have the team option. In Temple's case, in terms of options and other bird rights guys, they do have Joe Harris's bird rights. He's an unrestricted free agent otherwise, but they kind of have first crack at bringing him back. And it sounds like there's mutual interest on both sides in getting that done. Having his bird rights means they can go over the salary cap in signing him, which is good because, as I'll get into in a second, they are sort of already over that salary cap.
It's happening.
In addition to add to the team, they also have the taxpayer mid-level. Which I don't remember. I don't remember exactly what it is off the top of my head. It's the mini NLE, as they say. Right now, those 12 players that I just mentioned are under contract for deals totaling $133 million. That does not include Temple's $5 million option. It's $138 million if you do include that. So with that $133 million in Harris's cap hold, which is 14.5, which sounds pretty reasonable for his free market figure, you get to 148. That number is important because the projected tax line for the season is 139. The number that we really care about is the tax apron, which would be at 145 million, like $145.4 million overall. So Nets finding themselves in the luxury tax pretty squarely with that. Now, there is some discussion on where exactly that line is going to be set. It could pull back from 139 down to 132, which would obviously be a bit of a challenge for Brooklyn because they're already over it, overall. And if you're like thinking about, well, how do we have only 12 guys under contract? We haven't signed any big name free agents this year. How the hell did that happen? All of the outgoing salary from last year, so including Joe Harris's deal, including Wilson Chandler, Theo Pinson, the $5 million we paid to stretch Darren Williams last season, all of that comes off the books. That totaled about $18.5 million. But the raises that are due just to Caris LeVert and Taurean Prince total 22. So eclipse that already. Plus there's an additional $7 million in raises for basically everybody across the rest of the roster, $7 million total across the rest of the roster. So that's where the Nets are at. And I think, you know, that sets you up with two very obvious first dominoes to fall for the Nets this offseason, one being the decision on Joe Harris. So obviously something that they're going to have to go into the tax to pay for, but I think something that everybody kind of agrees is a bit of a no-brainer. Across the board, he's just the type of player, you know, first of all, you can never have enough shooting. Second of all, I think he's like an average defender. I don't think he's like a plus defender, but I think he's like a solid team defender. You think that's a fair statement?
I don't think he's killing you when he's out there. He makes smart decisions. If he's surrounded by folks that are also adequate defenders, he's fine.
So I think that's fair. And I think like ultimately, you know, on the one hand, I was a little bit optimistic heading into this offseason just because, you know, given the economic situation across the league and given the fact that so few teams have cap space, like, you know, maybe that would depress his market value a little bit. The more I have thought about it and heard people talk about it and read about it, you know, the more I feel like of all people, he probably does have a pretty decent market because he makes sense on any contender. You can plug him in on any contender. And he's the type of guy that, you know, if you were a young team, if you were a team with cap space, if you were the Hawks or the Knicks or the Hornets, he also makes a ton of sense to add there because his type of game doesn't stop the development of any, you know, young stars that you might be having. Like you could put him next to Trae Young and he's not going to get in Trae Young's way. He's, you know, by all accounts, a fantastic locker room guy. He's somebody whose story, I think, you know, is something that you want young players to be around. So it's a little dicey in terms of what that's going to cost. In sort of our figures here and the way that I've kind of been mental modeling it out, it's been just a straight 4-year, $60 million, $15 mil per year deal that I sort of foresee Joe Harris getting. I don't know that that's exactly what it'll be, but, you know, roughly when I'm slotting him in to situations, that's sort of where I think he will land.
Well, it's tough because it's not even contenders that would want Joe Harris. So what growing team wouldn't want an off-ball playmaker that can stretch the floor and doesn't necessarily take anything off the table defensively? That's a great way to evaluate the talent that you have on the team and give your young star a little bit of a safety release valve and space to do what they do best and evaluate what you have. It's not only the contenders because like no contender can have enough of that player that I just described, but it's a great way for growing teams to take a run at the playoffs or take a look at the players they have on the staff and figure out who could fit into that championship framework with somebody like a Joe Harris on the team.
And I feel like, you know, just given his skill set and given, you know, like let's say he gets that 4-year, $60 million deal, like not suggesting that he's underpaid at that point, but I think that's still a very tradable contract for just the reasons that we talked about, right? Because he scales, you know, anywhere you want to plug him in, I feel like he instantly makes that team better. So, you know, I think that's a reasonable estimate. I do think that's, you know, Sean Marks has called that priority number one for the offseason. I do think that of all the guys on this roster, he's the one that makes the most sense next to Kevin Durant and Kyrie Irving, just from a basketball standpoint. I know that there's been some question about, you know, the fact that he was not mentioned in Kyrie Irving's, you know, post-game tirade earlier this season in terms of the needs being glaring. So there is that. You could throw that out there. I do think, you know, as we get into talking about trades a little bit, like, you know, if you're looking at a trade with New Orleans where you take back like maybe a JJ Redick, like does that create some redundancy? I don't think so necessarily, but I could see that sort of softening the blow of missing him. You know, I guess my stance is pretty much just that they will definitely do what they can to bring Joe Harris back. I guess, Brett, like from your perspective, where does that money get too much? Like how much is too much for Joe Harris?
It's tough for me to envision him getting an offer that is too much for Joe Harris, because throwing $20 million plus at a player like that doesn't necessarily elevate the ceiling of your team. It just allows you to maximize the talent that you currently have, in my opinion. If somebody were to offer him $18 million, $20 million, I think that's when we would have to really take a hard look and say, okay, how available is a player like JJ Redick? Or if we don't get Redick, could we get a Seth Curry? Could we get one of those shooters out there that could replace 75% of what Joe Harris does at a much lower cost and also have additional assets that make the team a little bit better than just Joe Harris at that number? So I think it's the $18 million mark for me, but I'd have to look at what other players were also making around that amount and where they sat within the framework of their teams.
Yeah, I think that's a fair way to look at it. I mean, to me, it's just a question of like how easily do you think you can move that contract? And if you think you can move the contract, then I think you sign the contract, because, you know, really the only thing that I foresee being a problem, I mean, obviously barring injury, would be just opportunity cost of, you know, you go all in, you sign Harris, and then all of a sudden Bradley Beal becomes available. But Harris is the type of guy you could move for Bradley Beal, or you could move for another piece that could get you Bradley Beal. So I really don't have, you know, assuming that you know, Josiah is willing to dip into the luxury tax, which he will need to do at the numbers we're talking about, I don't really see a problem with bringing Harris back. And frankly, like for all the reasons you could dip into the luxury tax, I think that one makes a ton of sense. I think the other piece, sort of the other side of the coin that's tied to that, is the question around Garrett Temple's $5 billion team option. So if, you know, obviously you could do both, you know, like I said, you're pretty much bumped up at that luxury tax level without Temple's option and with a $50 million contract to Joe Harris. You're already $3 million past that, what we think the apron will be. So you're already into the luxury tax. You know, is it worth spending that additional, you know, I think every dollar you spend up until $9 million over, so every dollar that you spend on that Temple player option would cost you $1.50 in luxury tax on top of what you're already paying in the deal. That would be without using your taxpayer min level. So you'd basically be foregoing that to re-sign Harris and bring Temple back, assuming that, you know, any trade shift out in the same way. Like, I guess that's sort of the other big decision that the Nets have to make as well. And I guess the one last thing I would say on the Temple option too is, as we get into some of the trade scenarios that we'll get into in a second, you know, the good news is, even though they technically have to commit to that Temple option before you're able to legally talk about trades, obviously tampering is happening. And so they'll know, because Temple does kind of become an interesting salary match trade chip, particularly when you look at pairing him with like a Jared Allen, you know, where you could get, you know, potentially a $9 million, $10 million player back or sweeten a deal in that way. Because the Nets really, beyond Prince, LeVert, Dinwiddie, the Nets really don't have any sort of big salary matching blocks when you assume that DeAndre Jordan is not available to be traded. So I guess, Brett, like, I mean, do you have any thoughts on the Temple option specifically before I ask you my one question on sort of the roster?
I really think we're careening towards him declining his option and then re-signing with the Nets for a little bit less, especially after the events of this year. I think that players that do that won't necessarily be looked down upon this year or looked at as, hey, why are you helping these billionaire owners out? They don't owe you anything and they control the majority of the league. This season, you have a mulligan on that, and I think knowing that it helps out a couple of his good friends and helps the Nets get into a better spot to contend, given that he's never won a championship. He's 34 years old. We're both 34. We know how much stuff hurts in the morning when we wake up. He's not getting any younger. I could really see him doing that. So that's
– yeah.
Well, I've heard any whispers about it, but
– and just to be clear, it is a team option, so – it would be the Nets declining, and then
the Nets declining, but him coming back. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I do think that that's an option. And I think that it's a fair, you know, just from a financial security standpoint, like, you know, if he were to get slightly less per year, but a much longer contract, like I could see that that's a justifiable, you know, rational economic move, I feel like. So, you know, I have thought about that as well and modeled out a couple scenarios there, you know, that would remove your ability to include him as a salary matching block in a trade. But I do feel like, you know, when you talk about, which we'll get into in a second, sort of what the Nets need in terms of, you know, defense, like I think aside from Durant, like Temple's possibly your best non-center defensive player.
Oh, I was trying to play that out the other day. I was like, if you had to pick the best defender on the Nets, who would it be? And like you said, I think it's probably coming back from an Achilles, Kevin Durant, due to his length and the amount of positions that he can guard. But that is not a good spot to be in if you want to devise a championship caliber defense. So that does make Temple a little bit less expendable. And I think he was already in cost-saving mode when he came to the Nets on this contract last year. He could have gone to many other teams. He could have gotten paid more, and he chose to come to the Nets and chose to sign a contract with the team option. So I think he's already in that mindset of, hey, I'd love to compete for a championship, live in Brooklyn, and a couple million dollars here and there based on what I've made in my career doesn't make that much of a difference.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. So I guess like on that note, I think looking at that, let's assume that they're bringing back Joe Harris, and let's assume that in this scenario, because I'm saying they don't make or can't make any other moves, let's assume that they're picking up, they're bringing back Temple one way or another. It doesn't really matter.
Well, I also want to point out, though, it's not doom and gloom if we decline Garrett Temple's option, depending on how the rest of the offseason shakes out. If we don't replace his defense and his intelligence, or he doesn't come back on a less lucrative deal for himself, okay, that's a sign that the Nets might not be as focused on simply winning at all costs as fans would hope. But I think if we do decline his option, it most likely means that he's still coming back, or we have something so insane in the works that nobody's going to miss him.
Yeah, I think that's very fair. So I guess the question that I was going to ask was, take that team for just as it is, right? So in this case, if Harris is coming back, Temple's coming back, we're probably looking at Kyrie, Caris LeVert, Joe Harris, Kevin Durant, DeAndre Jordan, backed up by Spencer Dinwiddie, Garrett Temple, TLC, Torian Prince, I think would get the nod at the backup for Jared Allen. Where do you think that team sits within the East? And what are some of the what are the strengths and what are the weaknesses that you think they should address based on that? So basically, question is, where are they if they do nothing besides bring Harris back? And what kinds of things do you think they will need to do to better their standing within the conference?
Well, I'll start with this. I think that the North Star for our offseason should be recognizing how potent of a weapon the KD and Kyrie pick and roll is, and prioritizing elevating our defense to a level that's good enough to compete for a championship without taking too much off the table offensively. But that being said, we can make sacrifices on that side of the ball. because of how potent that's going to be and because it's not going to take sacrificing all of our players. So what I mean to say is we should be focused on adding pieces that increase the defense of the team without taking too much off the table offensively, but it's okay to sacrifice on that end given the Kyrie KD tandem. Now, if I had to list where the Nets sit in the East, that's a tough one because the roster as constructed has a lot of unknowns and maybe too many, which is why a lot of folks think the Nets are going to make a couple big splashes with trades this offseason because you have Caris LeVert. Is he bubble Caris LeVert? Will he be healthy all season? Spencer Dinwiddie, is he the borderline all-star from last season? Can he fit within a framework of a team where you have four ball-dominant players when he's not the most incredible shooter in the world, akin to Caris LeVert? Can he be the Draymond Green, like he says? What is KD going to look like coming back from injury? How many games is Kyrie going to play? What's he going to look like coming back from injury? There's just so many question marks associated with this team that to rank them is very, very difficult. I do think if you look at individual matchups in a playoff series, I don't see anybody in the East that could effectively guard Kevin Durant to a point where it would bother the Nets and really shut down a series. You could look at the Toronto Raptors and the sheer number of bodies that are long and fast and switchy that you could throw at Kevin Durant, but I just don't think their offense as is, especially if you consider Fred VanVleet leaving, is going to be up to the task. So I would position the Nets just because of the health concerns. I wouldn't make them the favorite to come out of the East, but to me they're top three, and I would bet money on them making the Eastern Conference Finals with the team as constructed.
Interesting. You're a little bit more bullish than I am. I think as constructed, I do think they're very good. I think Giannis could probably check Durant. So, you know, depending, and obviously, you know, I know about Milwaukee's kind of issues. I'm a little bit terrified just of the East in general, because I think you look at, you know, Milwaukee's been this kind of regular season juggernaut, never been able to put it together in the playoffs. But while I think it's easy to sort of bet against them because they've always had their challenges, that doesn't necessarily make me feel good about running up against them in a playoff series. Kind of same thing with Philly. Like, I think Philly, you saw this tremendous market correction on like what people thought their ceiling was. But if I'm still going into a playoff series with a fully engaged Joel Embiid, which maybe doesn't exist in fairness, and you know, Ben Simmons fully healthy, like even with some of the challenges that they've had, and obviously they'll make moves. But even if they didn't, like that is a team that still presents a ton of matchup problems. So I'd say, you know, certainly I think in a second tier, like in the sort of puncher's chance tier within the East, is where I'd put them with no moves. I think when you look at their strengths and weaknesses, I think what they need to be looking at is upgrading their defense, particularly on the wing. You know, I think the more wing defenders they can add to this team, the better they are. And I think, you know, specifically getting some kind of point of attack defense in there, I think should be one priority, because I don't really feel like they have somebody right now who, you know, if you have another scorer that is just on a run against you, like can really like lock them up. I think they have a lot of, like we talked about, like decent team defenders, guys, you know, I think Harris falls into that category. I think Caris LeVert can be very good, but is certainly, I mean, hasn't been, frankly, so far, consistently so far in his career. I think Spencer Dinwiddie can be, you know, a good defender, but really just don't have like the guy that's like, you know, who's checking your best guy. So I think that's one area that I would look into if I were them. So point of attack defense, wing defense, and then bringing in some kind of what I would call like a bully ball four, like one thing I noticed about the Nets is like, obviously positions don't really exist anymore, but they have all these kind of positionally fluid guys that are sort of, like playing at the higher end of their sort of positional fluidity, if that makes sense. So like, you know, I think like Caris LeVert's kind of a 2-3, they might ask him to play three. I think Joe Harris is kind of a 2-3. They'll probably ask him to play three. I think Kevin Durant's like a 3-4. They're going to ask him to play four. I don't really think they have anybody on their roster that would be considered a 4-5 tweener. And I think that's one thing that might be helpful for them. Somebody that can come in, play small ball center, but also guard wings, kind of muck things up inside, you know, whether or not they can shoot, I think would be another area that I would look into. And, you know, basically beyond that, it's just trying to fill out as many wing defenders as you can.
Well, that's what I worry about, because those players aren't easy to find. And it seems like a lot of the big trades the Nets have been thrown out with during the offseason have been associated with bringing in one guy that's a plus defender and can guard multiple positions. And that's great. But given the Nets' current roster as constructed, I think we're going to need two of those folks. And one of them is going to be able to, is going to have to be able to slide down fairly easily. And one of them is going to be able to, he's going to have to be able to slide up fairly easily. And it's, I think it's easier for us to recognize what the current holes are in the roster than to put together deals or signings that are going to plug those holes easily without giving too much away. And that, I think that's my biggest concern heading into the Nets offseason. Like, hey, and we'll get into this later. I don't want to talk about it now, but is Jrue Holiday the answer to all of our defensive problems? Absolutely not, but he does solve a lot of problems for us. Or hey, if we brought in Aaron Gordon and he committed himself just to defense, what is he the answer to bringing the Nets into a top 10 level defense, which would make us a championship contender? Probably not, but good Lord, would that also solve a lot of problems for us? And I think that's where the Nets sit right now. Do you really bolster one of those positions and then try to pick somebody up off the scrap heap that you can plug and play for a much lower salary? Or are there more marginal moves where you can really fill out multiple wings that don't take too much off the table offensively?
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. I mean, and a couple of things that I've thought about just sort of strategically on that front are, if you look at sort of the advantages that the Nets have, right, you've got in Kyrie Irving and Kevin Durant, you have two players that are incredibly adept at creating for themselves and creating offense, you know, not necessarily creating for their teammates in like a LeBron, like Magic Johnson kind of way, but at least, you know, like creating offense. So I feel like the need for floor spacing around them is, while important, maybe not at the same premium that you would see in other offenses. You know, particularly with a guy like Kevin Durant, who I think can get his shot off over anybody in isolation. So, you know, maybe you have the opportunity to lean into that a little bit more by finding guys, whether it's like a Mo Harkless, who's been somebody that's been mentioned at like a tax pyramid level, or even a guy like Rondae Hollis-Jefferson, like not to group those two together, because I think Harkless is somebody who can shoot, but it's a little bit more questionable, like a Rondae being a guy who like just can't shoot at all, but like could come in and, you know, bolster the defense, not be able to shoot and be sort of an undervalued asset that you could find. And because you're pairing him with Kevin Durant, who's 7 feet tall and super long, like your rim protection needs maybe don't take as big of a hit. And so if you want to play those two guys together in like a smaller ball lineup in the playoffs, you know, you could, you know, maintain enough offensive firepower while getting the benefits of that defense, and you know, not sacrificing too much in terms of rim protection. So we can get in and talk about that, I think, in a little bit, but that's sort of one area that I foresee, you know, potentially, you know, finding a cost savings or finding a way to do it, that works, or, you know, finding a guy at the end of the bench who, you know, might not be the sexiest name that you would see heading, you know, out of the offseason, but could be that second guy that plays alongside, you know, a Jrue Holiday or plays alongside whoever your sort of stopper is, and gets minutes in a playoff series, you know, as a defensive rotation guy.
Yep. Yeah, I see what you're saying. I think it's more about recognizing what do the Nets have an abundance of, what can they give up to try to strengthen the things that they lack in. And right now they have an abundance of on-ball creators, which is wild to say because that's one of the most sought-after skill sets in the NBA. And they also have an offense that's slated to be historic, barring major setbacks to injury comebacks, and making sacrifices made in those two areas not too detrimental because the floor is still so high there. So what can we bring back for giving up some of those assets or bringing in pieces that don't necessarily maximize those skill sets, like you said?
Absolutely. So let's talk about some of these assets, and then let's hop into some of these deals. So
let's do it.
You know, in addition to players, let's just also call out in terms of first round picks, the Nets have the number 19 pick in this draft, which is Philly's. So it wouldn't be impacted by the Stepien rule. They have their first round pick, you know, in every sort of subsequent draft. And I will call out that the 2023 first would be the year after both KD and Kyrie have a player option. So I think there's some sort of intrigue value there if they were to decline that option and go somewhere else. And then the 2024 pick, I think, is, you know, a fairly, you know, that's after their contracts expire. So obviously they could opt back in, but that would be the first sort of mega pick. So like if you were to go the full Billy King poo-poo platter, I think it would be that Philly first, maybe the 2023 and 2025 first with swaps in 2022 and 2024, because that 2023 and 2025, you'd have the outside chance that 2023 would be very good, and 2025 almost certainly would be really, really good. So
we're throwing out a starting lineup of DeAndre Jordan, Torian Prince, and name three other players.
Jordan will be dead from old age by then. So there's that. And then I think, you know, in terms of players, I think the number one trade asset by all accounts, so I'm assuming that, you know, KD and Kyrie are obviously untouchable. I think that DeAndre Jordan is immovable, or at least immovable, not because just because nobody would want him, but because I think just politically it's not palatable. So the Nets' best player asset, I think, by all accounts, is going to be Caris LeVert. I think because there's a lot of kind of banter around the league about, you know, just handing him his own team and letting him be his own creator, I think is really the path to seeing if he can be a superstar on his own, or at least a mega, you know, I don't know what the fuck the different striations of stars are these days, but like, you know, I think he can be an absolute star if you give him keys to his own offense, like we saw him in the bubble. So I think there's that idea that, like, okay, if I put him in a different situation, he's going to increase his value, and he's on a fairly team friendly deal that's just starting, so he's got 3 years, like $16 million or so this year, which means like if he does blossom into that type of player, you have him at a bargain price for a few years. Spencer Dinwiddie is on his last year under contract this year before having a player option next year. He's in the $11-12 million range. I think that range of salary, it's tough to find guys that are really effective there. And so Dinwiddie obviously fits that bill. And so he could, you know, he's another guy you could plug into a team that needs a point guard or needs somebody to do what he does, and, you know, get him in a bigger role and get some, you know, surplus value on that deal. I do feel like the types of teams that need that, it's maybe a little bit less, but, you know, we can talk about different landing spots for him. Beyond that, I think Torian Prince is your best sort of salary ballast, $16 million this year, or I don't remember his exact number. What is it? It's not 16, it's like 12.
Yeah, it was like 14.
14, that's right. So $14 million for Torian Prince this year. So, you know, when you're trying to get into those upper 20, you know, million dollar per year range guys like a Drew Holiday at like 25 million, you're going to use Prince as a salary match. I don't think he's he's somewhere between a neutral value asset and a negative value asset. Like I think if they were to just try to trade him specifically outright, I think you'd probably be attaching a pick to get off of his money, unless you could find similar bad money to take back. But if you were including him as part of a bigger deal, I don't think he like poisons the package that you're going to give, especially just because his archetype is so sought after. Like, you know, he is kind of a 3-and-D type archetype, even though the 3 had some struggles and the D also had some struggles. And then the one guy that I really can't make heads or tails of his value is Jared Allen. I should say there's also sort of just the platter of like Kurucs, Musa, you know, Kurucs, who I think might have some value, although the court case thing is kind of weird. Musa, I don't really know if he has much value, but he's $2 million. Claxton, I would throw into any deal as a sweetener if anybody wants him. And then, like, I could see like TLC being potentially a sought after asset by a team that, you know, needed that type of production, you know, later down the bench. But then the guy that I can't really make heads or tails of is Jared Allen. Like, let's talk about his trade value for a second before we get into modeling out some of these deals. Jared Allen makes $3.9 million, or will make that this year. He is extension eligible. I would be shocked if the Nets tried to extend him this season. But that said, like when I look at deals for him, so I'm totally open to throwing him into any other, you know, as a sweetener into any deal. But just trying to trade him on his own, it's kind of fascinating because I don't really feel like dollar for dollar, you're going to get his production from any other $4 million player in the league. Like I'm just looking at guys that make about his money. And here's a list of people that I would consider trading for. And I don't even know if I would trade him straight up for any of these guys. Dorian Finney-Smith, Nicola Melli, Daniel House, Miles Bridges, Kyle Kuzma. Do you trade any of those guys for Jared Allen straight up?
Probably not. And it's tough because those are skill sets that we need too. Like theoretically, Daniel House fills a void. Theoretically, Dorian Finney-Smith fills a void of folks that can guard multiple positions and theoretically stretch the floor in DFS's case and actually stretch the floor in Daniel House's case.
I think I'd strongly consider Finney-Smith for Allen straight up if I had a different center, like a different backup center option. But he's really the only one I'd get super excited about. Daniel House, I also don't know if like the Rockets would do that. So, you know, it's interesting. I think he can get packaged into a deal, but it's also like when you look around the league, like who's looking for centers right now, there's really only three or four teams, Charlotte, Sacramento, Golden State, that seem to be in the market for centers. And it's just a weird economic sort of situation for that position because you can kind of replace what you're, you know, most of what you're going to get from him for a little bit more than you're paying him.
But I think the Rockets are in the market too. I saw an interview with Steven Silas, who just took the head coaching job there, and he was saying that he'd like to bring in a bigger player to have multiple different looks to throw out there. And historically, if you look at the Mavs, they have always had some sort of presence that could block shots in the center, and even that championship roster with Tyson Chandler was built around that. So you can throw them in there. But again, adding one more team doesn't make the market massive for a player like Jared Allen.
Well, I think you just added two more teams, right?
Oh, the Rockets and the Mavs. Yeah, that's true.
Which is good. So that, you like expanded the market by 25%. Right. So that's pretty huge.
That's a good point because Porzingis is coming back from injury. He's not going to be playing a lot of minutes.
So I think that what's weird with Allen is like he's a good player. Like if you're looking at like the whole sort of idea of like, oh, you can replace most of what you're getting from him, like with like Robin Lopez or something, is like, I would, Robin Lopez is going to be slightly more expensive or at least a lateral move. And I'm going to get not nearly as much as I'm going to get from Allen. And with Allen, like, depending on his growth, like you could get quite a bit more. So there are a lot of scenarios where, I think he's totally available. I think they would be happy to put him in a deal. I think we've seen some quotes from him recently that indicate that like he is certainly expecting that he might be put in a deal. But I absolutely would be happy to go into the season with him and DeAndre Jordan as my centers, particularly if I'm getting, in trades where I'm getting a Drew Holiday, like having Drew plus Allen to me is a pretty interesting defense on its own without necessarily adding an additional guy.
Well, I think people are severely underestimating the leap that Jared Allen took in the bubble as well. He led all playoff performers in rebounds per game. Now we all know that wasn't a large subset of games to pull off of, but still it was against the Toronto Raptors who had Marc Gasol and Serge Ibaka and Terrence Davis and some of these guys to throw at him that aren't exactly slouches when it comes to being around the rim and bodying people away from the basket. And two, his finishing when he was more than a couple feet away from the basket, it was the best that I'd ever seen it. He was throwing in arm extended 2 feet above his head, offhand, little sky hooks, spinning in the lane like it was nothing. And I mean, I remember when this guy was struggling to pick up the ball on a bounce pass during his first season. So there is a ton of value there to be able to take the ball and make the most out of whatever position a playmaker puts you in. Because if he is on this team, that's what he is. He's the guy that gets the ball when something fails on the play and doesn't get one of our most efficient offensive players a good shot. And if he can clean up those little dump off passes and get anything to go in the basket within 5 feet of the rim. Where do we find that player, and where do we find that player on an equal value contract? And the answer is really nowhere. But that being said, I think some other teams probably noticed that. And if we can't necessarily construct a trade that matches the value of a player we're trying to get, throwing in that salary isn't the hardest thing to do. So he probably ends up being a casualty of a larger package.
I'm just trying to think if I want to throw out a casualty of a larger package joke. I think that that's really, you know, I think that's a really good point. I think the other thing that I would add just from his offense is, you know, his ability to distribute from the short roll, like,
yes,
as a playmaker and a passer, was leaps and bounds better than what we had seen during the regular season. And I think in particular, I mean, you could kind of go either way on the, you know, did Kenny Atkinson get fired because he started Allen over DeAndre Jordan kind of question? You know, I like to think of it, and this may be a little bit Pollyanna-ish, as just there was like a 6 or 7 week, 8 week stretch where DeAndre Jordan was outplaying Jaren Allen. And I like to think that, you know, Kenny was being too rigid in not doing that, and that was a manifestation of it, not that it really mattered that it was Allen or Jordan. But a big part of the reason that DeAndre Jordan was outplaying him during that stretch was his ability to like facilitate from the elbow. And it made the offense just that much crisper and really work with him kind of as the hub. I think if Allen is going to be able to facilitate from the short roll in that type of way, like that really opens things up, you know, just to be a completely dynamic offense. So I'm interested to see what happens with Allen. I would hope that he, you know, is valued around the league. And I wish the best for him. I would, you know, some of these trades that we'll talk about where he lands on Charlotte or lands on a team and really gets to blow up, like I would dig, because I think he's also like for a young team like that, you know, yes, you're going to have to re-sign him. Yes, you're going to have to pay him. I think he'll want Clint Capela money. I don't know that the market will bear that. And so I think you'll be able to get him at a pretty reasonable rate. Like, I think the pendulum is going to swing to where centers are a little bit undervalued just because you can always find, you know, some of their production for cheaper, but I think he'll be able to bring enough to the table that he'll be a good asset. So let's jump into deals, and let's start, I think, with Jrue Holiday, because that's obviously the rumor du jour. And what we've heard from around sort of the NBA podosphere is, Caris LeVert and stuff was the way that Zach Lowe deemed it. I think, you know, Brian Windhorst on the Hoop Collective, pretty similar, but the stuff would specifically have to include Allen. Stuff always includes, all of these trades include Torrey Prince. Just, it's like free with your meal. I'm really interested in if you can get that deal done without LeVert. And, you know, the Hardwood Knox podcast talked about, you know, potentially a Dinwiddie, Allen, Prince, and picks for Holiday, with Allen then getting shuttled to Charlotte and Miles Bridges back to New Orleans. I think that's pretty interesting. I definitely think bringing a third team in there, like I think if you're going to, like you had asked me a couple weeks ago, like, is it possible to get Jrue Holiday without including Caris LeVert? And the only way that works in my mind is if Jared Allen is really truly viewed as an asset in that deal. And if that's the case, I think that you need a third team, because I think New Orleans is pretty excited about Jackson Hayes. I feel like even if they value Allen, like, I don't think they'll see him as an upgrade there in such a way that it makes sense to get rid of him. So finding that third team to facilitate would make sense. I had also looked at a crazy three-way with Sacramento, potentially, where maybe you pull Harrison Barnes back to New Orleans. And I think Dinwiddie Allen, Prince, and I can't remember if I needed Garrett Temple's $5 million to be in there or not. But, you know, that's potentially an option. So that's, I guess, where I start on Jrue Holiday. I guess, do you have anything else that you've heard on that front before I get into sort of some of the meatier questions around a Jrue Holiday deal?
Well, you know, what I think I'm most interested in is, and I think you're right, that involving Jared Allen and the way that New Orleans views him is the thing that most likely leads us to having to involve a third team if we do want to pick up Jrue Holiday. And it's whether or not they value what Jackson Hayes could become more than they value what Jared Allen is right now. Because Jared Allen's never going to be more jumpily, second jump ability, athletic than Jackson Hayes. But Jackson Hayes could never develop, could possibly never develop into the person that's able to make double team reads and make the right pass, able to be in the right spot on a pick and roll and draw a lot of that gravity, and able to contest shots at the rim and go out to the perimeter in the way that Jared Allen has learned over these couple of seasons. You're banking on him growing into that role. And is he going to have room to grow into that role in New Orleans? And the more that I thought about it, the more that I think that Jared Allen actually could be a very valuable piece to them. And if Jackson Hayes works out, great, then you trade him and you get some value back for him. But as of right now, I think there's a lot of potential that you're banking on with Hayes for not a lot of upside that he brings that team to not take on a player like Jared Allen. And maybe I'm looking at this through rose-colored glasses, but that's the way that I view it. I get that they have a center that they just spent a pick on, but that wasn't this current front office or this current coach. And I think that could make him a little bit more expendable than folks are thinking, because they're not pot committed to Jackson Hayes.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. It would certainly make things easier if New Orleans valued his ability just straight up in a way that, you know, that he made that trade a sweetener. I guess, in your opinion, or I guess one other thought on New Orleans and Allen specifically, to me, if you're going to move off, so I think, you know, if you want to improve your defense, probably the best thing that you can do would be to keep Allen in a Jrue Holiday deal, because Holiday gives you that point of attack defender. Allen, I think, gives you, you know, a rim protector that is theoretically mobile enough to be able to switch a little bit, or switch enough, that I don't think he's automatically played off the floor in a series the way that other drop defenders are. And, you know, I don't hate the idea of banking on, you know, his sort of growth curve in that area being the thing that propels you, you know, into being a top 10 defense, and being the type of defense that you want to be in the playoffs. So I definitely like it from that perspective. If we're going to include Allen, I kind of like the idea of getting somebody like a Nicolo Melli back, who is, you know, similar salary to Allen. So like as a salary match, I think makes sense. I definitely don't think he's part of the Pelicans' core plans necessarily, although he did pair very nicely with Zion last year. He's somebody that, you know, he's either a power forward or a center. I'm not really sure. I don't think he's, you know, I think it's certainly a downgrade from Allen overall in terms of what it means for your defense. But I think bringing him in as a potential stretch five allows you to play like kind of what we were talking about before in terms of being able to cultivate the undervalued asset in terms of a defender, like a wing defender, switchy defender type that can't shoot. Like, I think having somebody like Melli at the backup five would allow you to play that type of player all year, get them reps, get them clear with that team, and then let them transition into a playoff role where, you know, even if Melli doesn't play in the playoffs, the fact that you could bring in, you know, a Michael Kidd-Gilchrist or a Rondae Hollis-Jefferson or an Amon Shumpert, frankly, you know, to play with your team, not necessarily need to stretch the floor because you've got a five who can do that. And then when you move into, you know, smaller ball lineups with like Kevin Durant as your nominal center, you know, they're familiar with the team. So that's just like one other area that I would think if you are getting off Allen, to me, like that's an opportunity to find a stretch big, whether it's through that trade or through other means, that would, you know, allow you to take a look, like to find a defender on the cheap because they're not able to shoot.
Well, that's a good point, right? Because for the on the flip side for the Nets, how replaceable is Jared Allen? Especially if you're getting a player like Melly back that adds a whole separate facet to your offense, and then you bring in somebody like an MKG, like you said, or somebody that can bang around down low and doesn't take something off of the table defensively, even though they might not have the length and the field goal percentage at the rim deterrent that Jared Allen does. If you're adding another player that brings another dimension to your offense, and you can pick up somebody that can play defense because center is the most replaceable position right now, sacrificing him in a deal, even though you're not getting back equal value, probably makes sense. And I think that's probably what the Nets are looking at overall. Unfortunately, there are going to be some players that are very good fits for this team, but they're not going to be equal in vacuum value to the assets the Nets are going to have to give up to get them. And I think that Nets fans, especially Nets fans that have become emotionally attached to a lot of these players that we either found or drafted, developed, are going to have to come to terms with the fact that, hey, these players could turn into stars on the teams that we trade them to, but that doesn't mean who we got in return for them in these trades wasn't worth it, because while it shortened the length of amount of time that we could be a great team, it elevated our floor and our ceiling for the next 2 to 3 years, which is really what this team is constructed to do. And I think that's been hard for a lot of us that have been with this team for a while to come to grips with emotionally. And that's how I see trading Jared Allen or trading Caris LeVert at this point.
So I guess if we're talking about a holiday deal specifically, like what's too much to give up in your opinion? Like what's the walkaway price?
For me, if we're giving two creators up for Holiday, that's the walkaway price for me. If we have to give up Dinwiddie and LeVert in that deal and we're just getting Drew Holiday back, I think that giving up two creators for one does take a pretty big dimension away from this team, especially considering that Dinwiddie and LeVert are not sibs on the defensive end. They're not as good as Drew Holiday by any means, but these aren't guys that you look at and you're like, oh wow, they're terrible defensively. You have to scheme around them. So I think that any deal that's not structured around giving up both of those guys on those contracts for Drew Holiday, I've made my peace with as a Nets fan, even though I don't want to give up Caris LeVert. I think that we're going to have to find a trade that doesn't necessarily bring back the same value as we value Caris LeVert.
So you're comfortable with either LeVert and Allen and presumably Prince.
Or
Dinwiddie and Allen, and presumably Prince. Now, is there
and a pick or something?
Is there? Yeah, I'm sure there'll be picks.
Multiple picks.
Is there anybody else on the Pelicans that you would want? Like, obviously, Redick's name's been thrown around. Like, is there anybody else on the Pelicans that you would want to see included in a deal, or you know that might change the way you're thinking about it?
Well, I mean, getting Redick back would be wonderful for us because you can never have too many players like Joe Harris and like JJ Redick. And hey, even if those guys can't necessarily or don't necessarily play together a ton, you have one of those guys that plays with the bench unit and one of those guys that plays with the starter, and all of a sudden you have the entire defense geared around watching where these guys go and trying to keep them from getting open and taking the focus away from whatever creator we have out there. That would be wonderful. You threw out a while ago, which I loved, Lonzo Ball's name in a deal, who I think would be a perfect fit with this team. And if we were somehow able to get him back and Drew Holiday in a deal that adds two plus defenders at the wing position who both can theoretically catch and shoot well enough that you don't have to sag off of them and have playmaking, that would just be so much fun to watch from the Nets fan perspective. Now, that might be something that I consider giving up a Dinwiddie and a Caris LeVert for, as Lonzo can theoretically run the offense, and we've watched Drew Holiday run an offense, but then we also are eligible to pay Lonzo because he's coming up at the end of his rookie scale contract, so that complicates things too.
Yeah, I think like Lonzo to me has been one that I've sort of tabbed as just super interesting because, you know, I think He's going to be extension eligible. So, you know, I forget what we were listening to earlier. It was like Real GM or something with Damian LaRue, where he was just talking about, like, you know, a great way to find an undervalued asset is to trade for guys that are about to get paid. And I think Lonzo sort of falls into that category because although he's developed good chemistry with Zion, you know, he's sort of not mission critical to what I think the Pelicans are trying to do in the way that Brandon Ingram is, in the way that Zion Williamson is. So, like, if there's going to be somebody that's going to lose that game of musical chairs, it's going to be him. Maybe they don't want to pay him. Maybe they don't want to deal with it. So getting rid of him could make sense. I think the Nets bring him in as, like, nominally a backup point guard, but who could also slide in as like a three, like a defensive first three. So the way I would see it is, if you did trade him, I mean, ideally, the trades that I've liked the most for him have involved LeVert, Temple, Allen, Prince, but not necessarily included Dinwiddie, and you pair Dinwiddie and him in the backcourt of the bench unit, and then you figure you can slide him in for Joe Harris and slide Harris back with that bench unit as well. That to me gives you two really good wing defenders, somebody that's pretty big, you know, for his size. And then, you know, the other thing is, although I guess you'd have to pay him as well, is, like, you know, one of the reasons why, if you can include Spencer Dinwiddie but not Caris LeVert, you know, you might consider doing it, is because Dinwiddie's player option is coming up next year, so he may walk for nothing. Ball, I think, gives you a little bit of reassurance and a little bit of confidence that, you know, you might not necessarily need to re-sign him, or at least you could go into those negotiations like knowing that you have a bit of an outlet to get rid of him. So, you know, that was sort of my thought on Lonzo Ball overall. And I think what we also sort of got into as we started talking through these deals was this sort of, and I think Lonzo Ball could fit into it. Although I think it would be difficult to get him without giving up Caris LeVert, but was this kind of Caris LeVert framework where, you know, whether you get Jrue Holiday or not, and it really started with me trying to make the most underwhelming set of trades I could that I still felt like made the team really good. And the framework is basically, if you're going to commit to Caris as the third star and you're going to lean into trying to make a trio of Irving, Durant, and LeVert work, then you're going to have to resolve some of the redundancy issues, in the sense that, you know, Caris LeVert's a guy who's going to be best unlocked when he's on ball. We've heard a lot about, like, okay, you just move him to be your sixth man. That solves that problem. If you were going to do that, then the way that I would, or the way that we looked at, you know, potentially doing that is maximizing his value by putting together a second unit with just as many defenders as you could possibly find, sort of such that all of them could toggle into the starting lineup for LeVert in the event that you needed, that extra defense there to help that starting group out. So the offseason that I had looked at in that scenario that sort of prompted this was, you keep Caris LeVert, you traded Spencer Dinwiddie and Torian Prince. Or so you traded Dinwiddie and a couple other guys to Phoenix for Kelly Oubre. I traded Torian Prince just straight up to the Bulls for Thad Young. Young being somebody that I think, you know, the Bulls aren't super, not a super great fit there. You know, he could make sense with the right contender. I've heard him talked about going to Portland a lot. I think he could be the type of player on the Nets where he could step in and guard Kawhi or guard LeBron, not necessarily shut them down, but at least take that assignment. He could also be a bit of your sort of bully ball. Like, I don't think of him as a small ball five, but just in terms of, you know, he's a legit four who I think if you put him with Kevin Durant could be a bit like that. And then, like, looking at, you know, a defense first point guard, whether that's, you know, signing like Chris Dunn, who's currently, you know, like, you'd have to use your tax pyramid level to get him, or, you know, doing some kind of a trade for Eric Bledsoe. But that just sort of worked out to Kyrie, Caris, Joe, KD, DeAndre Jordan, and then Chris Dunn, Garrett Temple, Kelly Oubre, Thad Young, Jared Allen. And so you look at that back lineup, or that bench unit, is all plus defenders all the way across the board. You could flip any of those guys in at any point for Karis, for Joe, for Kyrie, and, you know, run out a really strong defensive unit alongside Kevin Durant as well.
I mean, there's so many little marginal moves that you could make, but what does that take off the table when you make those moves? And it's, you know, one thing that I've been thinking about as we've been talking through these moves too, is that it just seems like the teams that the Nets are most likely to make trades with aren't a perfect fit for the pieces that the Nets have, but they have pieces that are perfect fits for what the Nets want. And I think that's what makes this so difficult and makes it a little bit simpler to put together one or two player trades or a one player plus pick plus somebody like a Musa for these marginal folks like a Thad Young, like you mentioned, because constructing something for somebody like a Drew Holiday becomes a little bit more difficult because the Nets' best assets don't necessarily make sense for their team. And that's where I think Sean Marks' brilliance is really going to have to come in this offseason, where I mean, not many multi-team trades happen unless Daryl Morey is involved, and that's another thing that we can talk about, trading with the 76ers and the trade that Vecini threw out there, where, hey, if you swap Dinwiddie and Josh Richardson, that is a wonderful fit for both teams, and maybe not, again, another trade where the Nets don't get equal value back, but it really helps us out. But are we going to want to trade with an in-division rival? And there's just a lot of little things out there that, oh, that makes sense. Oh, yeah, you know what? There's that one thing. Or, hey, that makes sense. There's that other thing that the Nets might want to consider before making that trade. It just doesn't seem like there's that perfect fit out there for us, which is almost leading me to a point where, like, do they actually try to run this thing back and make a move at the deadline and hope that something becomes available where they can throw all of their assets in, or do they not? And that is something that is still not being talked about. It seems like a certainty in the media, podcasts, articles, off-season previews, whatever you want to read or listen to, that the Nets are going to make some big moves during free agency. But maybe they don't, and maybe they bank on something becoming available at the trade deadline, because this is going to be a weird season. This is going to be a season where teams are not going to want to spend a lot of money. And one of the things that really got me thinking was, you know, what is an inefficiency that the Nets can potentially exploit in the NBA this year? And that's the whole Moneyball thing. I'm sure most of you guys have seen it, but it's like, hey, what's the inefficiency that we can exploit, or the undervalued thing? And right now, the one competitive advantage that the Nets might have is one of the few owners that is not only doing well, but did better during the pandemic recession. And maybe Josiah's willingness to go all in and be above the apron and not care about the tax and then the repeater tax could be a bigger advantage during these next two seasons than it's ever been in the history of the NBA. And that could be a really interesting subplot to watch if the Nets recognize that and Josiah's willing to go all in. And I think the way that they've spent on their assistant coaches could also be a bellwether of that too, where, hey, listen, Nash didn't come cheap. Amari Stoudemire definitely didn't come cheap. Oh, Mike D'Antoni? Yeah, he didn't come cheap either. Ime Udoka? Oh yeah, he was one of the most sought after defensive assistant coaches out there. So he's showing an ability to spend a ton of money in a season where the league is simply just trying to recoup. And I think that could be really, really interesting, and potentially either A, will you end up with a scenario where the Nets spend big in free agency and they just don't care because they know that they're going to go over the tax anyway, and if they need to make moves, they can spend to do that. Or they wait, knowing that they can always make it up with the amount of money they're willing to spend next offseason if what they want doesn't become available at the deadline.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting. I mean, we've talked about, like, okay, what if the Nets just go full Yankees? You know, I think to a certain extent, that path is not really available just because of the way that the cap works in terms of, you know, what you can and can't do with just free agent signings once your team is capped out. That all said, you know, I think it gets interesting as you start looking toward next summer and the summer after that. And so, you know, there's a certain amount of opportunity cost to holding, right? Whether it's foregoing somebody like a Jrue Holiday if he goes somewhere else, or you know, just the fact that you run through 1 year of what's going to likely be a 3 year window. But there's a certain amount of opportunity cost to, you know, making a deal. Like, you know, if you go all in on a Jrue Holiday deal, that's the only deal that you're going to make. So, you know, I could see either way happening. I think, like you said at the beginning of this, I do feel like sort of the discussion around this team has become, you know, they're looking for a third star. They're looking for a big move, just sort of because that's what the discussion has become. And I think, you know, particularly just because of the fact that they were in such a weird position this year, there was just nothing to really change the narrative away from that. So, you know, I do feel like the idea is, you know, you want to come back and be the best team that you can be. It doesn't necessarily mean you have to trade for a third star to get there. I think there are a lot of different paths that they can take. I do think that they have some key deficiencies that they're going to need to shore up. And so, you know, it'll be interesting to see how they do that. I do, it's, you know, it's heartening for me to hear you sort of classify them as being a top three or a top four team in the East, a top three team in the East, you know, just as is with no moves. So, you know, I think we see, you know, I think to me, I would be surprised if they're not pretty fully in the mix for Jrue Holiday. I know you've kind of talked about, you know, you go all in for somebody like that, and he doesn't quite get you to where you need to be in terms of being a great defense. But I do think he puts you a move away, and I think he puts you in a position where that move doesn't need to be, you know, you don't need to go out and get Patrick Beverley or Giannis or somebody else to pair with him. Like, I think that puts you in a position where you can make a move that's relatively attainable to get where you need to go. You know, and whether that's pulling in a guy like a Kid Gilchrist or pulling in a guy like a Rondé or, you know, trying to pull in, you know, somebody that may not be the type of player that you want overall, but can fill that sort of specialist role. You know, I think it makes a lot of sense. So it'll be an interesting couple of weeks for sure. I think I'm excited about it. I'm excited to text you on Thanksgiving. I'm excited to see, you know, Spencer Dinwiddie. Certainly seems like feels like he's getting traded on Twitter. So, you know, we'll see.
I think that's the best way to describe it that I've heard. Jrue Holiday doesn't necessarily get you there, but he gets you to a point where one more move does get you there. And maybe that is worth giving up somebody like a Caris LeVert, as long as you maintain enough assets to bring in that piece. But how can you anticipate what enough assets is? It's just such an interesting game of should we, shouldn't we, that Sean Marks is going to have to play without having definitive answers of the players on this roster. Like, he's not in an easy position, and he's in a position that any GM would want to be in. Don't get me wrong, but there's just so much uncertainty that could lead or bring pause to any move that he's going to make. And I don't envy that at all, but it's certainly going to be fun to watch.
I also think, like, to oversimplify and equivocate a little bit, like, if you feel like Jrue Holiday doesn't quite get you there, but gets you one move away, then you're sort of two moves away. Right. So right. I think to your point, you know, maybe I've been thinking about it in terms of, like, they need to put that championship level team out this season. But, you know, if they get one of two moves away this year, like, they can still add that second move next year too in the future. Like I understand sort of the idea of, like, hold your powder and, you know, go all in at some point for, like, a Bradley Beal or something like that. But, you know, if the issue with Holiday is you still need to make an additional move after that, A, I don't hate it. And B, I don't necessarily, you know, like, let's see how close you are and see what that move needs to be based on sort of what team you run out. Because I think ultimately with the Nets, like, the terrifying and exciting thing is, like, at some point it's going to just come down to Kevin Durant, right? Like, at
absolutely.
Some point,
yeah.
there's a threshold below which, you know, if Kevin Durant is, like, the 20th best player in the league or the 25th best player in the league, like, there's not a ton of hope for them. You know, they need him to be, you know, ideally, like, the third or fourth, but maybe, you know, the 10th or 12th. And, you know, there are just certain scenarios where, because of what KD is going to be, you know, within the realm of reasonableness, like, it doesn't matter what they do, nothing's going to work. So,
right, that's a good point. Like, do you go all in before you even know that? And how long does it take you to know that? And I think it will be very telling how confident the front office is that Irving and Durant will be here for a little bit longer than most people expect. I just think it's a running meme around the league that, and for good reason, of course, based on past history, because past behavior is a great indicator of future behavior, that Kyrie Irving and Kevin Durant are not long for the Nets, as they've never been long for any team they've been on. But hey, what if they are serious, and what if they're finally in a spot where they feel completely in control? Like, for example, if they thought that they were coaching the team for some weird reason, and they want to be with the Nets for the next 4 to 5 years, maybe Marks believes that, and that gives him a little bit more confidence that he can say, hey guys, we think something's going to become available. A lot of teams are going to be looking to shed salary, shed flexibility, maybe make a max roster spot for Giannis on the 2% chance that he even takes a meeting with you, and we can maximize, or we can capitalize on that at the trade deadline or next offseason. We think we have the talent to compete for a championship this year. Let's run it back, see where we're at, and we can always make moves at the deadline if we want to. And that probably behooves the Nets the most. But if you're in a precarious position with Irving and Durant, and you need to show them how committed you are and put your money where your mouth is and come through on some of the things that you promised when they signed here, that could lead to going all in for somebody like a Holiday, which, again, we both said isn't necessarily the worst thing in the world. But does it guarantee you a shot at a championship? No. Does it elevate your chances at a championship? Yeah, sure.
Yeah, I mean, I think, first of all, particularly if you keep Jared Allen, like, I think that a Kyrie Irving, Drew Holiday, Joe Harris, Kevin Durant, Jared Allen lineup is probably good enough offensively and defensively with DeAndre Jordan coming off the bench, like, to put you in that commerce, you know, to reasonably contend for an Eastern Conference championship. I pretty firmly believe that. I think you need a couple things to break right, and you need Durant to be healthy and all that, yada, yada, yada. But, like, I don't necessarily think that I look at that team and think, they definitely need somebody else. I think, you know, ultimately you're probably going to find that over the course of the playoffs. But I think it's a little bit easier if, you know, that puts you in a position where you're looking for one guy or one type of guy, as opposed to where the Nets are sort of now, where it's like, we need defense. And that's just very, very broad. And there are a lot of ways to go about doing it. And there's not necessarily like a right answer. So it'll be interesting. You know, I do sort of just always try to keep in mind that, like, the Nets want to win the championship. They don't want to win the offseason. And so, you know, it'll be interesting to see what's available to them, what they have to give up. And it sounds like the wheels are turning. I almost said the wheels are cooking. That doesn't make any sense. The wheels are turning, and you know, Sean Marks is working them phones. So we'll see where we land.
The meals are on wheels.
Don't tell my mom that. She loves meals on wheels.
The beals on wheels.
The meals are on beals. Once they trade for him and he gets a huge extension. Anyway, Brett, why don't you tell the fine people where they can find our work.
And they can find our work anywhere. You can follow us on Twitter at Russell and Fro. You can look us up on Spotify. You can look us up on Google Podcasts. You can look us up on Stitcher. You can look us up on Apple Podcasts too. We were approved by them a long time ago, which was a harder process than I thought it was going to be at the beginning of this whole thing. Feel free to email us. We still have the netspulse@gmail.com. Also russellandfro@gmail.com as well. And as always, this has been a ton of fun. Hope you guys enjoyed it too.
You can find us on Cole Zwicker's MySpace.
With Hard Knocks, better than Berkeley. They said you murdered me by the time I was 21. That shit disturbed me, but you never hurt me. Hello, Brooklyn. If we had a daughter, guess what I'ma call her? Brooklyn Carter. When I left you for Virginia, it didn't offend you. Cause you know I only stepped out to get dinner. Hello, Brooklyn.
How you doing?
That's our back.